Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us for our next session here. Thank you for being at the NMQF conference. We are talking about a very important issue this morning, and I am elated to be on the stage with some wonderful doctors who will help us think through and talk through one of the most important issues facing our country at this time. You know, out of all of the maternal issues that have been seen in the United States of America, over 700 women died during childbirth last year. What we know from looking at the statistics, or going deeper into those statistics, is that Black women were three times more likely to die during childbirth than other women, even when you compared socioeconomic status and normalized those statistics out. It's a concern not only for the people that look like me, that sound like me, and that live in the places that I live, but it should also be a greater concern for us all. There should not be a statistic that says like that we need to have this conversation about this topic. But today we're gonna have hopefully some experts talk to us about ways we can improve not only Black maternal health, but by improving Black maternal health, we will be able to improve maternal health as a whole. So today I'll be joined by some experts on this topic, and I'd love to engage you as an audience to ask us questions so that we can develop a full conversation and leave here with some actionable items that will help us all be better in this space. First, I'm joined by Dr. Rachel Villanueva, who will start us off with a conversation this morning about what Black maternal health could be and should be. So I'll start by asking you, how did you get here today, and what should we talk about?
Well, I took Amtrak down from New York. No. My name is Rachel Villanueva, as he said. I am an OBGYN in New York City, so I'm still practicing, and I serve as the president of the National Medical Association right now. So I think for me, the topic of maternal mortality is really a very important and has become my passion. The statistics, I think we've become almost numb to these statistics because we rattle them off quite easily. 700, 800 women are dying in birth in a year. Black women are dying three times the rate of white women in the United States. The United States has the worst numbers of industrialized nations. And we just kind of say them as though it's really a matter of course. And I think we really need to stop and really think about what and who we're talking about. We're talking about our sisters, we're talking about the women in our, or birthing people in our communities that, who are important to us. So one life is one life too much to be dying in what should be the most joyful time in a person's life and in a family's life. I think when people come into my office and they are so excited to have that positive pregnancy test, they come with a lot of hopes and expectations and dreams around this new life that's being created and that they're taking care of. And I think the last thing that a family thinks about is this person who is nurturing this new life dying as a result of this new life. And so I think we have so much work to do in this space. I am really encouraged, as I said this morning, with all of the thoughtful conversation that has been happening in this room, because I know that this is the space where we're gonna make that change that we need to make for the people in our community. I think we're not surprised by the numbers, three times the rate of dying and hospitalizations because of COVID. I think when we talked about obesity yesterday, we could have put those same numbers in. These are not numbers by chance that happen in our community. These are systemic and structural reasons why these things are occurring in our community, and I think we have to come together. I think this panel is such a powerful panel because it really looks at all of those factors that are implicated in the rates that we're seeing. It's not just what happens in the hospital, although that's a very important part of it. It's what's happening on the outside. How are patients coming to us? How healthy or how unhealthy they are? Where they're living? Do they have access to nutritious foods, as Dr. Fatima will talk about? Do they have access to green spaces? Do they live in a safe environment? We really have to consider all of these things, and I think that's what the panel is really going to discuss today.
Absolutely. I don't want to undersell Dr. Villanueva. She was the first student National Medical Association president to also become the National Medical Association president. So I think that deserves a round of applause as well. So next up, we had Dr. Rupa Basu, but I don't know if she is available to us yet. She was having some technical issues connecting. So until we're able to get her, she's appearing virtually today, connected to us. Why don't we go with Dr. Amber Hewitt? Dr. Hewitt is the Chief Equity Officer for the Government of the District of Columbia, and in this role, she serves and works in collaboration with district leadership on racial equity and the racial equity lens across government relations and operations in the District of Columbia. So, Dr. Hewitt, can you talk to us about your concerns in this space as well?
Sure. Good morning, everyone. Really grateful to be here. My name is Amber Hewitt. I'm the director of the DC Mayor's Office of Racial Equity and the Chief Equity Officer for the District of Columbia government. I'm a licensed psychologist by training, so I will defer to my physician panelists on some of the more clinical questions, but excited to be here to talk about how we're approaching this work from a racial equity lens, looking at government operations, and also acknowledging how government actions, both big and small, have contributed to inequities. I think that's a critical part of racial equity and justice work and the great opportunity that we have as government and policy leaders. And also talk a little bit about some of Mayor Bowser's priorities and selected investments around maternal mortality. This has been a priority for her throughout her administration. So as Joe mentioned, so part of our work is applying a racial equity lens. And I know that's become sort of a buzzword, but that simply means being explicit about race, being explicit about structural racism as a driver of racial inequities. Sometimes it's easy for us to sort of explain away racial inequities or disparities, say by individual factors or socioeconomic disparities. But as Joe mentioned in his intro, socioeconomic differences do not explain racial disparities. And an exercise that I often do with my government colleagues when we're talking about sort of how we can approach this work is a metaphor called the ground water approach. So I just want to walk you briefly through this visualization exercise to sort of think about how structural racism leads to inequities and how we have to really look upstream and not sort of just blaming the individual. So imagine that you are, you know, in your neighborhood and you come across one dead fish in a lake. What question or questions would you ask yourself? Most of you would ask sort of, what's wrong with that fish? How can we help that fish? But imagine it's the second day you're passing by that same lake and it's hundreds of fish belly up in this lake. And usually when I do that exercise, there's a lot more alarm. What's going on in the water? Is the water toxic? I need to get out of here. But if you take that exercise one step further and say on your long walk throughout your day, every body of water that you are passing by has hundreds of fish belly up in the lake. And that's when we have to think about the groundwater, which we know all of our water streams are connected to. And that's what we use as a metaphor for structural racism. So what are the institutional policies, the implicit bias that, you know, within medical education and medical practice, what are some of those policies and upstream determinants that we can address that's causing those disparities? So that's how we're sort of looking at this work in the District of Columbia. That's highlighted in several of the mayor's investments and also in breaking ground on the Cedar Regional Hill Medical Center in Ward 8, which will increase access to maternal and newborn care, but also some of those social and structural drivers. So there was a DC Health Equity report that was released in 2018 that named 9 key drivers that are contributing to poor outcomes. And I know we'll talk more about that later, but I think it's important to address that, but also put that in the context of racism, sexism, and other forms of oppression. And I'll just end by saying some of the ways that Mayor Bowser is sort of looking at the whole system of care, not just what's happening in medical settings, but looking at food access. So she developed a food access fund that provides grants to having greater access to fresh foods, $1.5 million to direct cash for 1 year for select expectant mothers. So it's also important for sort of think about the whole system of care. So that's sort of the lens that I'm bringing to the conversation.
And that's a great lens for us to have, in the, especially as we go to our next panelist, who is one of the foremost experts on obesity throughout the United States of America and also the world. So next up is Dr. Fatima Stanford. Dr. Stanford, why don't you talk to us about your perspective here today?
Absolutely. First of all, it's a delight to be here with you this morning, and it's just wonderful coming behind these two wonderful women who've really set me up to talk about what I'll talk about. As was mentioned, I'm Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford. I'm an obesity medicine physician scientist at Massachusetts General Hospital, and I'm also an associate professor of medicine and pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. I'm one of the first fellowship-trained obesity medicine physicians, and why that's important is when we talk about this disease we call obesity, which we discussed yesterday, we have to recognize how that's related to the health outcomes that we've been talking about today. What we do know is that obesity is the most chronic, prevalent disease that we've ever seen in our lives. When we're looking at the numbers here in the United States, over 110 million Americans have the disease of obesity. About 220 million have both overweight and obesity. We're talking about over 74% of the population. I want you guys to capture that in your brain. Now, when we talk about this and we talk about the disproportionate impact on women of color, particularly Black women, we have to hone in a little further. Because as was stated yesterday, what we do know is that 80% of Black women have overweight and obesity. When we look at COVID-19, which Dr. Villanueva brought up, she mentioned something extremely important. She talked about the overlay of maternal health and COVID. We heard this issue about racism. What we do know is that the number one risk factor for dying from COVID was obesity. The number one risk factor for sickness, hospitalization, ICU stays for COVID-19 was obesity. And what we do know, even though I'm not an OBGYN, but I do know this from Dr. Villanueva and her colleagues, is that 50% of all pregnancies in the United States are unplanned. What we do know is that when we go into a pregnancy, there's a concept that happens called fetal programming. That means if a mother goes into pregnancy with overweight and obesity, she has increased inflammation or inflammatory markers in her body, which is being transmitted to her offspring. And so what ends up happening is we see increase in things like cortisol, CRP, which is C-reactive protein, all of these inflammatory cytokines like IL-1, IL-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha, all of these things, and also MCP-1. What that then leads to is this exposure in utero, which then increases the prevalence of chronic diseases in the offspring. We see not only obesity, we see non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, we see hyperlipidemia, which means high cholesterol, we see diabetes in the offspring. Now you may be like, okay, so what does that have to do with the mom? How can we modify that? I told you 50% of pregnancies were unplanned. We have this idea of fetal programming that we can actually modify. There was a large study that came out in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism in 2009, which was a prospective study. And it did one thing, it compared children born to mothers prior to the mom having bariatric surgery and the same mom and dad having a child after the mom had bariatric surgery. Now you may wonder, how does bariatric surgery play into this? What they saw comparing the older offspring to the younger offspring once the mom had been modified, her weight status, her cardiometabolic risk factors being, addressed, they saw a threefold decrease in the risk of severe obesity, a tenfold decrease in obesity. And those same, the genetics didn't change, but we changed the mom. In addition to that, we saw improvement in hormones like ghrelin. Ghrelin is a hormone that stimulates appetite, that tells us to eat more and store more. That was significantly decreased in the offspring that were born after metabolic and bariatric surgery. So the message why I'm trying to convey to you is that we need to modify mom's preconception. But I told you that 50% of pregnancies are all planned, which means we need to modify everyone, right? That's what we have to do. But how do we do that? We first begin to recognize that obesity is a disease. And as was mentioned by Dr. Hewitt Garcia, racism plays a large role. So if we look at the Black Women's Health Study, which is the largest study ever evaluating Black women, what we do know is that individuals that experienced racism as documented by the Black Women's Health Study had higher levels of obesity. These were mostly college-educated or above Black women. So this goes back to the point Dr. Villanueva made about socioeconomic status. We're looking at highly educated, the people in this room, having outcomes that are worse than our white female counterparts. Is it fair? No, it isn't. Can we do something about it? Yes, we can. We need to begin by addressing issues like racism. And when people get uncomfortable about me talking about racism, I could care less, because I don't get a chance to choose what I look like when I wake up in the morning, and I don't take off this blackness when I finish my day. So when we talk about this, we have to recognize that this plays into the maternal outcomes that we're seeing today. Let's modify ourselves. Let's speak up in the face of injustice. When John Lewis gave me the Gold Congressional Award in 2001, he told me one thing. And he was my congressman growing up, so I had learned a lot from him. He told me one thing. He said, Fatima, never stop fighting injustice. And that I won't. And those are my opening remarks. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Stanford reminded me earlier that she pledged in 1998 and I pledged in 1999, so she was going to be my big sister.
And he's
on this
my
panel.
Little brother.
And, hey, so that's where we're going to go with it. So I'm going to go back to you and ask you one question. Like, what strategies can be utilized to optimize weight status in Black women in reproductive age?
Well, I think the first thing is we have to recognize it's a disease and actually treat it as such. What we do know is that despite the higher prevalence of overweight and obesity in Black communities, we are 50% less likely to receive a diagnosis of the disease. So if we don't even receive the diagnosis, you can imagine we're not getting the treatment. And even if you look at the whole population, we know that only 2% of the population that meets criteria for metabolic and bariatric surgery gets that treatment. That's of all comers in the United States. And only 1% that meet criteria for medication for the treatment of the chronic disease of obesity get access. So we're talking about 3% of individuals, that's everyone. And then imagine how those numbers narrow once we get to looking at racial and ethnic minorities. Studies that I've published in JAMA, JAMA Pediatrics, et cetera, show that what happens is we are less likely to get referred. We are looking at the numbers both in the pediatric and adult populations for both bariatric surgery and pharmacotherapy, and we're much less likely to get access. We need to start treating our women with respect. We need to start treating this disease as the chronic disease it is, and we need to optimize their weight and health status, their cardiometabolic health status, preconception.
Okay. I see we've been joined by Dr. Basu. So Dr. Basu, let's give you an opportunity to give your opening statement. I want to make sure that you can hear us. Thumbs up, yes?
Yes.
All right. So we'll turn it over to you for your opening statement.
Okay, thank you so much. I am Dr. Rupa Basu, and I really thank you so much for letting me join virtually today. I think for my introduction, I'm gonna just show a few quick slides. So by training, I'm an environmental epidemiologist, and that just means I do a lot of studies on environmental exposures and health outcomes. My focus is really just a little bit of a background. I know some of this we've already discussed, and let me start here. My title is Epidemiologic Studies of Adverse Birth Outcomes from Heat Exposure, a Closer Look at Disparities. And I just wanted to, from an epidemiologist's point of view, add that heat really affects all organs that we've studied so far in humans. There's the classic heat-related illness and dehydration, but also cardiovascular mortality and morbidity, mental health, liver and kidney disease, gastrointestinal disease, respiratory, diabetes, and of course, adverse birth outcomes. I've talked a lot about some of the adverse birth outcomes. Preterm delivery is a big one, stillbirth, and term low birth weight. Just to kind of talk about why it is important to look at symptoms of dehydration. Symptoms of dehydration are often the same as symptoms of pregnancy. So headache, nausea, vomiting, for example, are often overlooked and are often not connected to the heat itself. And so it's really important to look for some of these symptoms and avoid some of these adverse outcomes that could result. The dehydration actually leads to oxidative stress and inflammation, which releases oxytocin, which decreases uterine blood flow, decreases fetal growth, and induces labor, often prematurely. One of the first large-scale studies that was ever published, I'm happy to report I was an author of this study. I really thought of this for my own pregnancies. I know that heat impacts the elderly. At this point, we were thinking that it was really just the elderly that were at high risk. Didn't even think about all the other populations. But I did notice that during my own pregnancies, I felt the same thing that I've been writing about, that I wasn't able to thermoregulate efficiently and control my body temperature, feeling hot at times when other people weren't, trying to change environments. So I thought I would look at temperature and preterm delivery. And then found this disparity by race, and all mothers that were studied had increased risk, as you can see here. But I just want to point out that compared to white mothers who had a 6.6% increase per 10 degree Fahrenheit increase in apparent temperature, Black mothers had almost a 15% increase. We also see this increase among Hispanic mothers at about 8% and Asian mothers at 10%. So really, the disparities are pretty clear here. And I was a co-author of this review paper that was published a couple of years ago. And it was a systematic review in the US. And since that first study was published, we've had many studies in this review. For example, there are 68 studies. These are just in the US, but we've seen this same association in international studies as well, and really shows that there is an association between fine particulate matter, ozone, heat, preterm birth, low birth weight, and stillbirth. That is consistent across all of these locations. But of course, the most another finding is that there were disparities by race across these studies as well. And I want to really point out, we've talked about some of the reasons for disparities, but we didn't talk yet so much about the environmental racism or environmental justice issues. Really, there's also not just, we talked about some of the healthcare issues, some of the disparities of workers and in the healthcare field, but we didn't talk about the environmental risk factors as much yet. So really, I just want to point out that Black mothers, also Hispanic and Asian mothers, sometimes often live closer to power plants, fossil fuel combustion areas, freeways, traffic. These are all exposures that increase for air pollution, particulate matter, but also heat. Urban heat island effect is actually pretty large in these communities because there is less green space and a lot of blacktop to absorb and retain the heat. Lower socioeconomic status has also been discussed. We know that that explains some of this, but not all. And with air conditioning, we know that these associations between temperature and these adverse birth outcomes still exist. So really, that's not the only issue here. And of course, we can't rely just on air conditioning because of power outages and blackouts that we've already seen. And of course, less access to healthcare. But even with the same access to healthcare, there's still differential treatment. There's not enough minority women, particularly who are healthcare practitioners, providing healthcare. Community involvement is also very large. Because I do want to point out that a lot of this is preventable. So if we can study, what are the reasons for these disparities, we can actually also address these disparities, is what the hope is, and really reduce a lot of these adverse birth outcomes due to climate change exposures. We know that climate change is getting worse, so we really need to act upon this. And that is it for me. Thank you so much for your attention.
Some sobering statistics. Thank you very much for sharing those, not only slides with us, but that information, because it sets the tone for the rest of the panel about not only the external factors that may help us arrive at this conversation, but also some of the ways that they can be improved. I know federal legislation is one of the big drivers of how we change this conversation, and right now Congress is considering the Mom the Bus bill, as well as a number of different states are considering legislation around this. To date, federal legislation is the primary driver for the state adoption of high-value maternity services, including looking through Medicaid and how Medicaid adoption allows for increased spending on a lot of the maternal issues that we'll also address here today. I've been asked some questions to pose to my panelists, so I'm going to start with you, Dr. Villanueva. How do you advise birthing persons of color to advocate for themselves in a biased healthcare system to mitigate their increased risk for maternal mortality?
I think that's a great question. It's really something that patients come in asking about. And I think if you, as much as we see the statistics, birthing persons are seeing the news and understand their own risk, so they are coming in asking, how can I keep myself from dying in birth? I mean, it's really a difficult way to start off what should be a wonderful conversation with your patient, but that's the reality of the system that we're in. I think the first thing I always really want to keep in mind is that the patient is not at fault here, right? It's really nice to create that narrative where we talk about women or birthing persons not being educated enough to understand what they should be eating, how they should be acting, how they should be exercising. But I think we really understand that the onus is on us as the healthcare provider to really understand, and I think we talked about this yesterday when we were talking about obesity, understand the whole person, understand where they're coming from, understand where they live, their limitations perhaps at whether they have enough, I think Dr. Knight spoke about this yesterday, whether they're cooking for themselves, which they generally never are, but they're cooking for a family and what they can afford to cook for that family, whether they can afford to exercise, whether they live in an area that is safe, as I said before, to exercise in. So I think it's really important as the providers that we are looking at the whole person and not just really cookie cutter approach to taking care of a birthing person. But I think what Dr. Cody talked about was really important is those preventable things before patients get pregnant. And so for me, it's almost as important that first prenatal visit as the visit before that when they're just coming in for their pap smear or regular visit. And I discuss with them if they're considering getting pregnant or even if they're not on birth control. I think that's really something, those unintended pregnancies is really a place where we can make a significant impact. But really discussing and looking at those modifiable risk factors. I think my patients know that I am very much of a physical education and nutrition, I will say advocate. I think that's a nice way to put it. I don't think they would think about it that way. But I think some patients are taken aback by the questions when they're not pregnant of, what are you doing for exercise? How are you physically active, especially in COVID? Most people were not even leaving I live in New York, so their apartments for days on end, and how that impacted their overall health. How are they? What are they eating? Are they binge eating? A lot of people in these times of stress have been binge eating and poor nutrition, and really just looking at those modifiable factors. We know that overwhelmingly for women of color, we're dying of cardiovascular disease and hypertensive disorders in pregnancy and postpartum period. So really looking at the fact that 50% of women over 20, black women over 20, have hypertension, and really addressing those factors. Do they have a primary care physician? Do they have a physician home? Do they feel comfortable with someone to discuss those issues? And if they don't, they know that I'm discussing it with them. And I think that having those discussions about those modifiable risk factors that they have, whether they're already pregnant or thinking of becoming pregnant, or just trying to keep our community safe in general, really looking at those things. I also really do speak to patients about advocating for themselves, just in the healthcare space in general. I think it's really important that it's difficult. It's a difficult conversation because we want them to trust us as their healthcare providers, but we also know that there are many reasons why they don't trust us, many reasons why they feel disrespected and have been disrespected in our healthcare system. And really having them understand that their concerns and what their feelings are valid. And if they don't have, if they don't feel comfortable in a particular setting, that they have the option and the ability to go somewhere else. And I think that's very important as well. I think so for me, I think it's really looking at the patient when they come in and those modifiable risk factors that can improve their overall outcomes, whether they're pregnant or not.
Dr. Hewitt, we've talked about systemic issues that have led us to this place. What role can government policymakers play to improve the systems of care, not only for women, but also women of color, and also women dealing with maternal health issues?
Thank you for that question. I'll build off of what Dr. Villanueva said about looking at the whole person, but also looking at the whole system and recognizing that birthing people and women of color and black women specifically have been advocating for themselves. I'll always think about Serena Williams and the experience that she had to go through when she was giving birth and trying to explain sort of what was going on with her, one of the most recognizable black women in the world, very well resourced. So I just wanted to highlight that point, but advocating within a system that has already those institutional barriers. And I think it's important to think about this holistically. And one of the things that, I started off my career as a child psychologist and a psychology professor in transition to government. And one of my constant observations is that it's very easy to be siloed in government. And we have to look at issues when it comes to racial health inequities, particularly maternal mortality, that we have to look at how all of these structures come together. So what's happening in the healthcare system, but how that's tied to other sectors as well. So, for example, if you put affordable housing in an area that has poor performing schools, what do you think is going to happen to the kids in that neighborhood? They're probably going to have poor educational outcomes. So we have to look at this holistically, and I think that's something that we're trying to do and really implementing the DC Health Equity Report that really identified those 9 key drivers that I think we've touched upon, such as nutrition, we've talked about housing, education, employment, income, transportation, the food environment, the outdoor environment, and community safety. So how can all of those sectors come together and focus on improving health outcomes? So we recently convened a health equity summit, and we had representations from the Metropolitan Police Department, the Fire Department, Department of Insurance, Securities and Banking, the Department of Energy and Environment, similar to our other panelists who talked about air pollution and environmental hazards. All of these sectors have to come together to focus on health outcomes. The onus can't just be on the fabulous providers and the fabulous systems, but all of those other sectors that are contributing to those poor outcomes. And one of my favorite thinkers on this topic is Dr. Joya Kriya-Perry, who talked about, you know, you can write a prescription for housing, but that isn't going to cure someone's housing insecurity. We really have to have deep, affordable investment. So one of the things that we're trying to do as policymakers is making sure that we're looking at all of these inequities holistically, but also as we're developing policies and programs, how can we apply a racial equity lens? We can have a universal goal, but we may have to have targeted strategies. And we know that folks who are closer to the policy problem also have the policy solutions. So approaching this from a policy implementation and policy design standpoint, from a strengths-based and asset-based approach, and really prioritizing the voices and the women and birthing people who have the lived experiences as we're developing policy and program interventions.
I just wanted to piggyback on that. I think the legislation that we're looking at, Momnibus and Congresswoman Kelly's Mamas Act, those all look at like comprehensive aspects to maternal care, everything from implicit bias training, increasing diversity of clinical trials, increasing the prenatal workforce. It looks specifically at those social determinants of health. It looks at mental health issues, really just that holistic approach that you're speaking about. I think the sort of issue always becomes the money behind the the policies, but I think those, if we, you know, if just those legislation themselves could really make a significant impact in the maternal mortality crisis if we could get those passed.
I think at last check there were 170 sponsors of the Mom the Bus right now. We're still looking for more sponsors of the legislation so that it could be passed. Hopefully, I know that we just had Black Maternal Health Week. And there was a big push to get more sponsors on the bill, but there's still a lot of folks who have Black women in their districts that vote for them or vote, or at least have the power to vote in their districts, that should be listening, should be considering sponsoring this legislation. And hopefully after we leave here, some folks will send members of Congress emails, letters, or communication expressing why they think that's an important thing, just as Dr. Villanueva has just shared. Now, behind legislation is usually research and policy, policy conversations, like Dr. Basu, and the information that you presented to us about how environmental and other factors should be considered when you are thinking through legislation. Placing a freeway is one thing, but placing a freeway and having an understanding of how that will also affect maternal health in a neighborhood is also something that we should be concerned about. How can we help women understand their role in advocacy throughout the equation, not just after they've become or birthing people have become in a situation where a child may be imminent, but also as they're members of the community, how they can advocate through research such as your own to help improve the health outcomes of the entire neighborhood?
Well, that's a really excellent question. As I mentioned before, it's preventable. And so if we can, I'm really more on the exposure, the environmental risk factor side of things. And I think that if we can reduce exposures, that would really benefit us in the long run in terms of adverse birth outcomes. And also somebody mentioned it's a long-term effect. So what I mean by that is if a baby is born preterm, there will be often consequences throughout childhood, throughout adulthood, neurodevelopment, brain and also heart, respiratory effects. And so it's really important to start from the beginning and prevent some of this. And the ways that it could be done is that we often work on reducing criteria air pollutants for developing standards in the state of California. And we also help with the federal standards as well. And by looking at vulnerable communities in a little bit with more emphasis, I think would help a lot. If we just look at the entire state, for example, that's not gonna be as helpful as really kind of honing in on the areas that are most impacted. Maybe, you know, not just by race or ethnicity, but also maybe more of this asthmatic population, just as an example. So we're trying to do more of that, trying to get better at it. But I think that that is an area that still needs a lot more work.
So if we place them in a healthier environment on the outside by looking at their exposure, looking at environmental issues that may pop up around them and seeing if we can mitigate, now we move towards how we can help them be healthier on the inside. All right, so Dr. Fatima Cody, Stanford, what are some of the factors that we should consider, nutritional, exercise, to help them be more healthy on the inside as well? Not only the birthing person, but also the people supporting the birthing person that can help.
So absolutely, I think that, you know, one of the key things I want us to kind of broaden our perspective is when we look at, for example, something like obesity, we often think of it as a nutritional disease, and I want to make sure that we don't conflate nutrition with obesity. While that is one component, what we do know is genetics, development, environment, and behavior play a role in a person's likelihood of developing the disease that obesity. And the key thing that I want to make sure that I don't leave this stage without saying is that weight is more heritable than height. And so I'm going to say that once more, because you're like, what did she just say? And that is that weight is more heritable than height. That means that if a child is born to parents that have the disease of obesity, there is a 50 to 85% likelihood, even with optimal nutrition and physical activity and resources, that they will themselves have the disease that is obesity. And so when we have our biases, we talked about, for example, bias training, these things of that sort, we look at families, we might see them walking around and we're like, gosh, what are they feeding those kids? when indeed it was transmitted by their parents, not necessarily what they're feeding. Maybe they're really going in hard. And so let's think about what we're talking about in terms of nutrition. I don't need you to go and get on this fad diet or this fad diet or this fad diet, because as soon as you lose weight, your hypothalamus, which is the part of your brain that defends your set point, your weight will return to where that set point is and actually come above that. That's called weight cycling, okay? So when we get on the grapefruit diet, for those that are old enough to remember that, or the cabbage diet, okay? Or, you know, we can keep going because we know that Atkins and keto are basically the same thing, all right? So if we go on these diets, we cycle, and then we come back to this point that's even higher, and then we wonder why our weight titrates up, because the brain gets very angry with us. What we need to be doing sustainably over the life course is looking at things that we need to be eating, and this is regardless of your diet preferences, which is lean protein, whole grains, fruits and vegetables, and the less processed, the better. I don't ask my patients about the number of calories they're eating because I do not care. Let me tell you why I don't care. Because a calorie is not a calorie is not a calorie, right? If I were to give you a bag of jelly beans, which is, let's say, 1,000 calories. I have no idea what's in a bag of jelly beans. Let's just come up with a number. And I give you 1,000 calories worth of kale, chickpeas, hummus, tomatoes, and cucumbers. The brain does not see those the same. What we do know, and actually this is studies that came out of Kevin Hall's lab at the NIH, that in just 2 weeks of exposure to a processed diet, which means it doesn't look like it looks in nature, and no, cheeses do not look like anything in nature, you guys, okay? Let's make sure we just get rid of that. That's another story for another day. But anyway, we compare that to those that are non-processed. They brought them in the labs at the NIH, and in 2 weeks, they saw a deviation in weight status regardless of very insignificant differences in the calorie intake that one took in. So that's the physical, that's the nutrition part. Physical activity, which is my thing, my favorite thing. I didn't see any of you guys in the workout room this morning while I was doing my tread boot camp. Just thought I'd call that out. But anyway, so other than that, what we do know is we want to promote physical activity, but we don't want a cookie cutter approach. I always tell my patients, they're like, well, what do you do? I said, no. What do you enjoy doing?
Yes.
I want you to do what you enjoy doing, because what you enjoy doing is what you will do in the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So for example, I hate skiing. If my doctor came in and told me that was the activity I needed to do to stay fit, I would be inactive because I hate skiing. Now, if you want to do some high intensity interval training, we can go there, but that's what my body enjoys. So it's about meeting them where they are, finding where they are, and then we look at the type of activity. So we look at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity physical activity. What that means is you could talk but not sing during the activity unless you were like Beyonce. All right, then you could do both, okay? But in general, okay? That's what we're looking at. But for most patients that have overweight and obesity, we actually have a target of 300 minutes, which would be the equivalent of about an hour 5 days a week. That's the target that we want to maintain over the life course, not just starting Beachbody and working out with Sean T. That's cool, right? I love Sean T. Sean T and I are cool people. I mean, he doesn't know it yet, but now he'll know. But the whole thing is I want something that's sustainable over the life course, something that we can do. So when we're talking about nutrition, physical activity, those are important. But we need to look at those larger things. So a lot of people don't know that the medications that they take are responsible for their obesity. You're like, what? 20% of the weight issues we have in this country are due to medications we as doctors prescribe to you for other issues. Like, which ones? Lithium, Depakote, Tegretol, Celexa, Cymbalta, Effexor, Paxil, Zoloft, Ambien, Trazodone, Lunesta, Gabapentin, Glyburide, Glipizide, Glimepiride, Metoprolol, Atenolol, Propranolol, long-term insulin, long-term prednisone, just to name the ones I felt like saying without running out of breath there. But the whole point is that we're not evaluating those things when patients come in. We're not evaluating how stress may have contributed to their excess adiposity. And during COVID-19, people think it was the activity that led to weight increases. Actually, several studies have been published that showed that actually physical activity went up. That's why Peloton stock went up during the pandemic, for example, for those high SES individuals. But what we do know universally, regardless of your race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, the thing that went up universally was stress. When stress goes up, what happens? Storage of adipose. Adipose is fat. The organ that is fat, storage of adipose goes up because our brains can't recognize that this is going to last for a long time and we don't know when this will end. So the weight shifts that we saw as the CDC maps became darker because they were heat maps had to do with stress. And so we have to tackle stress. And we know that communities of color are experiencing greater stressors over the life course than other communities for the many reasons that have been really elucidated today.
So before we get ready to go to questions from the audience, you know, I know from being the son of a preacher that you have to give specific asks if you want people to actually do things, right? So H.R. 1897 or the Mamas Act is the thing that we have been told to advocate for. So I want to make sure that you have that number in front of you, H.R. 1897 and the Mamas Act. That was sponsored by Congresswoman Robin Kelly, who's done a great job advocating in this space. So I want to make sure that we, before we get ready for questions and answers from the audience, if you have any questions, please, there are two microphones at either side of the room that you can line up for, and we'll start calling on folks to ask those questions. But before we get there, I know Dr. Villanueva, you shared with me that you like exercise. Dr. Stanford, you shared that you like exercise as well. Dr. Hewitt, did you want to talk any more about your exercise goals? Or Dr. Basu, I want to make sure I don't want to get in trouble with anybody, not let anybody talk about their exercise advocacy before we go to questions. I'm a Peloton guy myself, former athlete, currently serving as counsel at the NFL Players Association ahead of their government relations. So I'm around guys that exercise a lot, and I know that that becomes a factor in life. So we're,
but they stop exercising. Let me just stop them. They stop exercising once they get out of the league. Average life expectancy in the league, 2.1 years, if I'm not correct.
3.4.
Oh, okay. So
we're working on it.
But the whole point is that we need to keep them exercising. So have them come talk to me.
I'm going to talk to you after we get done.
Especially your offensive lines. So just bring them up.
As a former offensive lineman, I'll take all of those pieces of factor. Ma'am, can you ask your question so I can get out of trouble, please?
Yes. I'm Dr. Chelsea Moreland. I am a family physician by trade, but I do full spectrum care, including prenatal care. And so my question is, what are you all's thoughts around some of the innovative models such as centering pregnancy that we have available to us, but that a lot of our colleagues aren't utilizing yet?
I'm sorry, centering, what models are you speaking of? I'm sorry.
Centering pregnancy, so it's a group-based prenatal care model that...
Okay. I mean, I think you bring up a very valid point. I think that's why we come together in spaces like this to have those discussions. It's really, for us, so important, as we know, for those taking care of birthing persons to keep that holistic model and that patient-centered model. And I think just making sure that our colleagues do the same. I think as was said previously, we have always taken care of ourselves. And I think there's especially some new technological platforms and health platforms that are specifically geared towards the birthing process, using doulas. I think in New York City, that's going to be actually covered, midwifery and doula services for our patients as well. So I think it's just continuing to advocate for those things. Yes.
Thank you.
Hi, Dr. Gabriel Felix. I'm a psychiatrist in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So thank you so much for this panel. And I'm glad we talked about inclusivity and, you know, talking about climate justice, housing security, you know, food apartheid, as I like to call it, and how that affects birthing people. I'm wondering if you could all talk more about, you know, any local or national initiatives that you may or may not be in, you know, involved in, just so that we're aware of, you know, other efforts to kind of address this, you know, issue with health equity in terms of birthing persons.
I think I'll just say, as president of NMA this year, maternal health has been one of my priorities, and women's health in general, reproductive justice, have all been part of our priorities. One thing that we've been trying to do is really more in outwardly facing to our patients themselves and providing resources.
How to allocate. Like, I know, for instance.
So we have partnered with a pregnancy and parenting website to provide a maternal health resource hub to discuss issues of Black maternal mortality, what patients can do, to provide them with resources about modifying their preventable risk factors early on, talking about vaccination rates, which are particularly poor among Black birthing persons in the United States, and how this is important in protecting themselves and the unborn children. So really going toward providing those resources to patients themselves, because I think birthing persons are really, they're struggling. They're really coming to you as a provider scared, and they are looking for They're looking for you not only to take care of them, but to also understand how they can help to take care of themselves.
I'll add a couple points. I don't know if this directly answers your question, but in the realm of environmental justice, we saw the Biden administration release at the federal level racial equity action plans, and that's definitely a movement we're seeing across jurisdictions. DC, we're currently developing our racial equity action plan, so not just maternal health, but sort of health broadly, inequities broadly, and really looking at it holistically. But I also think another thing that the Momnibus addresses is around data collection, so making sure that we are disaggregating data by race, ethnicity, primary language, and other factors to track our progress over time. So that's one thing that we're trying to do a better job in district government so that we can sort of see how we're moving the needle, but also when it comes to health equity, sort of looking at those other social and structural drivers and breaking down those silos and looking at interventions that are cross-sectoral.
So a couple other things, right? Like in the Mamas Act or HR 1897, there's also the establishment of regional centers of excellence around maternal health that could become a part of the legislation if passed, as well as the Alliance of Innovation on Maternal Health that would work on the ensuring the hospitals in those areas adopt and implement data-driven maternal safety bundles as well. So. Another reason why the legislation by Robin Kelly is really important for us to find other people to help sponsor so we can get it passed.
I think it's a standardization of care. It's really also, Mama's Act also looks at the maternal mortality review committees, and those are so important because they take a root cause analysis as why each particular maternal death, what happened, how do we prevent that, what was there a failure of the system? Usually there was. And I think that those critical evaluations of each maternal death as in communities, because in certain communities you see differences. I'm in New York, and the maternal death rate is 8 times that for Black women as white women. So.
Yes.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for this panel. My name is Madhuri. I'm the director of the Kennedy Satcher Center for Mental Health Equity at Morehouse School of Medicine. So I'm coming from a behavioral health perspective. I appreciated the commentary on stress tolerance. I've been privileged to be a behavioral health provider in lots of different types of settings. I think one of the biggest things I've always heard is I can't make the appointments. And that's really because you may be in an apartment where you're taking care of not only your own kids, somebody else's kids, your grandparents, etc. And I think about mobile health as kind of an innovation in the developing world and other countries that have been really effective in reducing maternal mortality, but also kind of combating that stress tolerance piece. And in behavioral health, mobile health has actually started expanding a lot in the country, like 988 and psychiatric crisis line now will kind of make that a priority for folks in crisis. It makes me think about how much that can be bridged. And so my question is also incentivizing providers to want to work in spaces where there may be a provider desert. So, you know, for example, if there's only one culturally responsive clinic in an urban setting, that may be the only place that's serving thousands and thousands of moms. But as well in rural parts of the country, like American Indian, Alaska Native folks live on tribal reservations, sometimes only accessible by helicopter in certain parts of our country. So if a mom is in crisis, can't be reached. So I'm curious to know how you feel about bridging that gap in those parts of the country where we have a provider desert. Because stress tolerance, if you're being told by your doctor, reduce stress, it's a lot harder, especially as being a person of color is stressful in general in America. So I think part of that is something that I always think about from mental health equity, but mental health is integral to overall health.
Yeah, actually, I want to address this one because I think one of the key things that we have to think about, particularly we saw this elevation of telemedicine, which you didn't address during your actual comments. I think, you know, a mobile model, we've used that at Harvard Medical School to go out into the communities of Dorchester, Mattapan, for example, for many years. But what we find and what I have found during the pandemic is I was delivering 100% telemedicine to my patients for 14 months straight, is that you can get to them. And interestingly enough, many of them do have a smartphone. So they may be looking, you may be looking at the ceiling and tell them to like bring it back into view, but you're able to get to them where they live. And actually it's easier than them trying to trek into downtown Boston for me, pay $40 per hour to park, all of these types of things. They can go into the closet at, you know, the 7-Eleven where they may be working and talk to me for a few minutes, and then I can at least have a touch point with them that allows me to bridge that time. And so that allows us to get into those communities where we are resource constricted and provider constricted. Now, I happen to know that I grew up not too far from Morehouse in Atlanta, so you happen to have a large, actually the zip code of 30331 has more black doctors per capita than anywhere in the country. So they have a different circumstance than like what we have in Boston, where I'm seeing many people that are in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s telling me I'm the first black doctor they've ever seen. I'm like, oh gosh, because it's very different than my lived experience growing up in Atlanta. So I think we can utilize mobile health services, but that may be resource intensive, whereas telemedicine is not as resource intensive, allows us to get to individuals either via phone, smartphone, or if they have good broadband, which of course is another issue what we've been talking about nationally, about making sure that people have that broadband access, which for example, in the state of West Virginia, for example, I've heard that over 50% of the state is still on dial-up, which is just bewildering to me. So you have to recognize how we can get there. We can use asynchronous visits also, where patients just type a little thing in like they're due to a text so they can tell you what's going on with them, particularly in mental health circumstances where it may be something that needs to be responded to immediately. So that's just my perspective on how we can use both the mobile care model, which I think will be one thing to use, but more a little bit more resource intensive than using telemedicine to get the providers out to where they need to be.
Thank you.
I have a question. My name is Dr. Regis, and I was on an earlier panel, and I've been a board certified gynecologist and OBGYN doc since 1982, and served on several committees looking at this premature labor and delivery, black infant mortality and morbidity. And I gotta tell you that this panel has really encouraged me, because over the past 40 years and so many committees from University of Pennsylvania, John Hopkins, so many major medical centers, I began to wonder whether there was something intrinsic about our experience here. When you X out all these other factors, there's something else going on here about our experience being in America that resulted in these results. And from listening to you ladies speak and gentlemen speak, it encourages me, because I was beginning to have some doubts that whether we could actually change or level out the experience that black women and babies experience in this country, because of some of the background stress and inherent inequities that are there and that I don't see going anywhere anytime soon. But the work that you guys are doing, it really encourages me, because I was very discouraged. So I want to give you kudos for that.
To change the mic, I'm not as tall. Okay, hi everyone, I am Dr. Tiffany Bell Washington. I'm here from Harvard T.H. Chan. I'm getting my MPH, I'll be done in less than a month, so I'm very excited about that. I'm a quadruple board certified physician, actually specializing in psychiatry, child and adolescent psychiatry, lifestyle medicine, and obesity medicine. So what I wanna say is thank you very much for this talk. I thought it was amazing. The panel is awesome. I wrote a few notes, so I don't forget, but I'll be very fast. Maternal health is very important to me for many reasons. I'm a mom of four children, five and under. And I wanna say, even as a physician, my experience as a patient was just what? That.
Let's give her a clap.
Wait. We're not going to skip over that.
We're going to say it and run, okay, just in case. So, and I'm awake, so that's good. I had an experience even as a physician where, I had to tell them, I'm a physician. I'm concerned about, for instance, my blood pressure. This is a problem. They're like, oh, you're stressed, don't worry. I'm like, no, pay attention to this, And so I think we have to advocate for our patients in that way, physically, to say, if I can't do it as a physician, how do they do it as someone who didn't graduate from high school, when you're arguing literally with your doctor to try to save your life. So that's the one thing. On the other side, I want to say that just as a psychiatrist part of me, I think it's very important. I'm also BPA, I'm a trustee for the Black Psychiatrists of America. And I just want to say that we have to focus also on the mental health part of it, because we're all seeing stress, right? Stress with obesity, stress with the death that happens in maternal mortality. And I just want to make a plug that as much as we can, we prioritize the mental health, maternal mental health as well. And I think the bill might have some money going that way. I'm not exactly sure.
It does.
Okay,
it does.
Perfect. And I just want to put that out there because there's stigma with both, with all of these. There's stigma with obesity, there's stigma with mental health issues. And if we don't focus on it, I think our people will continue to die. And it's very concerning. So I just wanted to put that out and tell you thank you all very much. So thank you.
Thank you. All right, we have 1 minute left on this panel, and I would love for everyone to get closing statements, but if you could say one closing sentence instead, that'd be awesome. Start with Dr. Villanueva, then we'll go across.
I just want to say thank you for an amazing panel and the opportunity to speak today. I think we really just need to continue to advocate for birthing persons in our communities and really advocate for and support legislation that supports the infrastructure of our community and investments back into our communities, because it's really those social determinants of health that really undergird all of the issues that are plaguing the excess chronic burden of disease in our communities, so including maternal health and obesity. So just thank you.
Dr. Hewitt.
Thank you as well. I mean, I learned a lot from the esteemed panelists here. I know we've talked a lot about the social determinants of health, but just also wanted to highlight the political determinants of health. And I think there was someone from stature, Daniel Dawes, who wrote a book on that and you know, how legislation can determine health outcomes. And I know we've been talking a lot about the Momnibus. So I just wanted to highlight that and also put a plug for, if you're in DC, September 15th, Mayor Bowser will be hosting a maternal health summit later this fall, but just thank you.
Dr. Basu?
Yeah, again, thank you also for letting me join this panel, especially virtually. You know, as a researcher, I come from a different viewpoint, I think, and, you know, we could keep doing all the research we want, but until we have some changes, some policy changes, some conversations like this, I don't think it's going to really go anywhere. So I think it's so important to have these discussions, to make changes, and to really improve health. And, you know, we've talked a lot about Black maternal health, but always, I know we keep this in mind, but it's really a healthy environment overall. You can't be healthy if you're excluding parts of your population. So it's really, you know, that's, I guess, the message that I'd like to leave with is, it's really, if we're looking at the most vulnerable, then we're protecting everybody.
Thank you.
And just very briefly, what we have learned today is that maternal morbidity and mortality is a complex, multifactorial issue. And we can't silo these things out. We need to look at comprehensive strategies and structures, like House Bill 1897, Senate Bill 916, which you guys are going to go talk to your senators and congressmen about today, to move this forward, begin to think about these things, and begin to take action as soon as you leave here today. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to be a moderator on this panel. Again, if you didn't miss House Bill 1897, Senate 916, I can't follow that. I'm just going to say goodbye. Thank y'all.